Hey there, everybody. It is July the 14th, 2010. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm Ken.
And I'm Becca.
And you're listening to us on WVEW LP 107.7 FM Brattleboro Community Radio. We are also broadcasting with pride worldwide on QNation.fm. You can also check us out, stroll on over to clickexpose.com, and they have tons of other really cool podcasts, too, so you definitely want to go check them out. We have an amazing show for you this evening. We will be welcoming Dean Spade a little bit later in the show. That's a listener-requested guest. That's going to work out really well. So I wanted to kick off with, did you read about the Georgia gubernatorial race?
I did.
So this is, and hopefully this will work, if not, you know, whatever. This is former Secretary of State Karen Handel, who it is my impression that she's in the lead for the Georgia gubernatorial Republican nomination. And she apparently years and years ago, or maybe not even that long ago, had written what she called a sponsorship check to the Log Cabin Republicans, which is a gay Republican organization. So this reporter was on her tour bus, her press tour bus, and he started asking about gay marriage. And I have to play some of this because it's pretty good stuff. Here we go.
You're against gay marriage,
mm-hmm.
right?
Absolutely. Marriage is between one man and one woman, and I've been very, very clear about that, and record is very clear on any of the other issues like domestic partner benefits or anything like that. In fact, at Fulton, I voted no on domestic partner benefits.
Are you against civil unions for gays?
Yes. I think that's not so much an issue that has come forward in Georgia because we have the constitutional amendment against gay marriage, and I don't want to see any taxpayer funding going towards funding benefits, etc., for a couple that is not married and in our state. And for me, marriage is one man and one woman.
And why is that?
Why is marriage between one man and one woman?
Mm-hmm.
Are you serious?
Yes. But do you view committed gay relationships as being less legitimate than committed heterosexual relationships?
As a Christian, I view marriage and relationships as being between a man and a woman.
That was former Secretary of State Karen Handel talking about her views on gay marriage. Let me sum up what I heard. Number one, no gays in Georgia.
No.
Not a one. Not a one of the gays in Georgia. She basically said it hasn't come up because, you know, there's no gays. And then that laughter, the laughter of, wait, serious? Wait, are you being serious? Why is marriage between one man and one woman?
Because it's in the Bible. Have you read the Bible? Have you read the Bible? Seriously.
On and on. She says, quote, gay parents are not in the best interest of the child. It's a great interview. I was going to do a whole role play where I was going to print out these scripts and you were going to be her and I was going to be the reporter, but I couldn't get my printer to work. But it's a fun party game to do with your friends. What I would do is Google gay parents not in the best interest of the child and Handel, H-E-N-D-E-L, and just get together with your friends, maybe do some agitprop theater out on the street where you live and act this out. Because when you put it in a different context, it's really disturbing.
Maybe we should get busloads of people to go to Georgia and do this
where
on like every street corner, you know,
no
just
gay people.
No.
None.
And in the Bible there were no plural marriages.
No, none. So that
which
again,
I just love. It's one man and one woman.
Secretary of State, Karen Handel. We cannot espouse any political views here, but she's an idiot. That's not a political view. That's just an observation.
No, that's kind of personal, actually.
Yeah, I crossed the line. That's fine.
Yeah,
I mean, cross that line. Okay.
I don't know about the other guy. He might be just as dumb.
Well, that's kind of funny that you say that, because the other guy who's running against her, the other conservative dude, is using this as an example of, well, she's waffling on the gay issue. What is she going to waffle on next? So he gets to highlight, she wrote this check to the Log Cabin Republicans. So gay issues very much at
the
forefront.
She probably didn't know what that meant.
No, she says earlier in the interview that it was just a good fiscal decision. They're a very fiscally sound group. Those fiscal gays who should not be allowed to marry, but it doesn't matter because there are no gays in Georgia. We are going to play a little ditty right now in honor of Karen Handel. This is a song called Ladies First.
Ladies first. naked. Those that don't know how to be pros get evicted. A woman could bear you, break you, take you. Now it's time to rhyme. Can you relate to my sister dope enough to make you holler and scream?
Hey, yo, let me take it from here, queen. Excuse me, but I think I'm about to get into precisely what I am about to do. I'm conversating to the folks who have no whatsoever clue. So listen very carefully as I break it down for you. Merrily, 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 high and happy overjoyed. Please, with all the beats and rhymes my sisters have employed. Look at me throwing down the sound totally a yes. Let me stage the position. Ladies first, yes?
Yes.
Yes.
One, but for being with one, cause when it's not for loving, it's the woman that gets them sworn, stepping, strutting, moving on, rhyming, cutting, and not forgetting. We are the ones to give birth to the new generation of prophets, cause it's late.
I break into a lyrical freestyle, grab the mic, look at the crowd and see smiles, cause they see a woman standing up on her own two. Sloppy slouching is something I won't do. Some think that we can't flow, stereotypes, they got to go. I'ma mess around and flip the scene into reverse.
With what?
With a little touch of ladies first. I'm divine and my mind expands throughout the universe. A female grapple with the mess to send. The queen Latifah is a perfect specimen.
My sister, can I get some?
Sure, Moni love, grab the mic and get dumb.
Yo, praise me not for being simply what I am. Born in L-O-N-D-O and sound American. You dig exactly where I'm coming from. You want righteous rhyme and I'ma give you some. To enable you to age yourself and get paid. And the material that has no meaning I wish to play. Pay me every bit of your attention. Like mother, like daughter, I would also like to mention. I wish for you to bring me to the rhythm. Of which is now systematically given. Desperately stressing, I'm the daughter of the sister. Who's the mother of a brother, who's the brother of another. Plus one more. All four have a job to do, we doing it respect due. To the mother who's the root of it. And next up is me, the M-O-N-I-E-L-O-V-E. And I'm first, cause I'm an L-A-D-I-E.
Contact them in fact, the style it gets harder. Cooling on the scene with my European partner. Laying down track after track, waiting for the climax. When I get there, that's when I text the next man or the next woman. It doesn't make a difference, keep the competition coming. And I recite chapter in verse. The title of this recital is Ladies First. On the mic, the scene is right, the crowd is hype. I expel the whack and those who white. Why? Cause I'm that type. Swearing with beats 45 King style. He wants me to sing, but I'll swing. So meanwhile, a footnote for the opposite sex. Phony rip the mic, I'll rock it next. Plus, you never catch me at my worst. You get the drift? It's ladies first.
Queen Latifah and Moni Love singing Ladies First, Crazy Enough, from 21 years ago. How crazy is that?
That is kind of crazy.
What do you got over there on the news side? Hit me with a story.
I am just going through the news right now and trying to see. Well, we didn't cover the Department of Justice reviewing the Massachusetts rulings yet. That happened this last week.
It happened, like, right after we were on the air.
I know. Well, no, Massachusetts' decision was right after we were on the air. But there's still silence at this point. I mean,
anything.
Yeah, the White House hasn't said anything. Department of Justice hasn't really said anything yet.
We'll see.
That's the Defense of Marriage Act.
Then let's stroll on over to the happy land of Hawaii. We talked about last week, Governor Linda Lingle. Who vetoed the civil unions bill, and she said she was treating it with respect and dignity and respect and dignity. And then, oops, this was her quote. Quote, for those people, this was after, in a radio interview last Friday, she defended her decision, and this is what she said. Quote, for those people who want to make this into a civil rights issue, and of course those in favor of the bill, they see it as a civil rights issue. And I understand them drawing that conclusion. But people on the other side would point out, well, we don't allow other people to marry even first cousins or a brother and a sister and that sort of thing. Oops, did we just compare gay marriage to incest. I do believe we just
did just do that.
Thank you, Governor Linda Lingle, who said that she treated supporters of the civil unions bill with, quote, respect and dignity as befits their incestuous nature. So that happened. I kind of like this. This story was... We like stories about straight people doing really cool things.
Are we talking about Manhattan?
Love it.
I was just thinking we should go there.
Love it. Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer is planning to marry his fiancée, Elise Buxbaum. And they're not getting married in New York.
No, why not?
They're going to go to Connecticut, where marriage is legal for same-sex couples, rather than in New York, where it is not. Stringer says the decision is a protest against New York's decision not to embrace marriage equality. He said, quote, if enough people who have somewhat of a profile, not just politicians, but artists and business leaders, start going into Massachusetts or Connecticut or Vermont. I just want to put that wasn't in there. But
no, it wasn't.
Vermont.
Implied. Hey, we're here, too.
It was an implied or Vermont. And show New York how embarrassing it is that you can't get a marriage license for same-sex couples. Then we will change things. So, applause to you, Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer. Very cool. I like that story. What else?
And we should point out that that was actually his fiance's idea, not necessarily his.
I don't care.
Well, let's give the lady who's not the politician a little credit.
Thank you, Ms. Buxbaum, soon to be Ms. Stringer.
She said that when she broke the news of, told the news to her friend who was a longtime lesbian and... longtime friend, I should say, not longtime lesbian, because I don't know how long she's been a lesbian. Probably forever. But that changed her mind and made her reconsider it.
So many comments.
I know.
Choose one.
It's hot in the studio. And okay, I can't use the concussion thing again anymore,
can
I?
No, you're done with the concussion. I can't use being jet-lagged anymore. You can't use the concussion.
We're out of excuses, world.
Kind of stinks. Also out of excuses are the court system in California. 2.5 years after the shooting death of gay California teen Lawrence King, to whom my dissertation is actually partly dedicated, it's dedicated to him and Matthew Shepard, a jury may finally decide the fate of his alleged killer. The Los Angeles Times reports that the defense attorney was denied another continuance in the trial by Ventura County Superior Court Judge Charles Campbell. Campbell said today that the defense had ample time to prepare the trial and they need to get going on this darn thing. That's my quote, not his. The defendant is being charged as an adult for first degree murder. The victim was an openly gay teen who would occasionally wear high heels and makeup. He often clashed with the defendant, especially in the days leading up to the incident. A jury will be picked for the trial before an official start date is set. So they got to get going on that trial. Which, you know, trial's not a good thing, but justice and getting some closure on this and hopefully bringing even more attention to this young lad who was so tragically murdered is ultimately a good thing. Ultimately a good thing. What do you got over there?
Shocking news.
Okay.
Mormons or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, like the actual like head of the church, is against gay marriage. Did you get that memo?
I did not know that, but
they restated it in, you know, the last week or so.
Yes,
just wanted to reemphasize
it. No, and we now know that was a pretty.
I'm sorry, but
hardcore sigh.
After Prop 8, do we really need like another memo? You know,
it's really more of a post-it. It's more of a hey, put it on your fridge. By the way,
we still think you're going to hell.
That wasn't in the post-it.
It wasn't.
It was just implied. Hey, getting back to our Lindsay Lohan story, which Becca
appropriately,
we have to, because as you so importantly highlighted, it's a gay story. It got an even gayer story. It got even more, you know, gay. It's fun. This week with the title of the article.
There?
I think it is. The Sun is the first media outlet to publish the inevitable lesbian prison gang story in advance of Lindsay Lohan's forthcoming 90-day prison stay, according to the reputable Fox News. Published by the Rupert Murdoch-owned news group Newspapers, The Sun reports that an inmate at California's Linwood Correctional Facility warned the British tabloid that Lindsay is a prime target because of her celebrity status. The inmate who is serving time for heroin possession and prostitution allegedly said, quote, "The gay inmates wear their shirts inside out to let others know that they are available. So if Lindsay doesn't want someone to grab her ass, she better keep her shirt on straight." I'm going to just stop reading the quote because, but I just wanted to let everyone know that that continues to be a gay story, according to Fox News and some British tabloid. How ridiculous is this?
Great.
Even more so.
Awesome.
I gave it some, you know, airtime.
Thanks for that.
Hey, I'm here to help, folks.
Yes.
One more story and then we're going to a song. Hit
Are
me.
We? In the Pentagon world.
Yes.
I don't know. The Department of Defense, I suppose. They're not going to segregate straight and gay troops.
No. Well, they released the survey that they were giving out and about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And some people were really upset about the survey, saying this just uses inflammatory language and it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And so we'll
see. Did you sign that petition?
Yes.
I got that petition in the email today.
I always wonder what becomes of that, but I sign it regardless. It's important.
You do what you can.
You do what you can. All right, let's play a little bit more music. For all the folks out there, this is a really fun one. So this is a song called Reading Rainbow, and it's by the Lost Boys, and I think you're going to enjoy it. So I mandate that you enjoy it.
If in a book, a reading rainbow, a reading rainbow, a reading
Remembering back when I was just a little bee sting, I wore overalls, but overall the whole world was big and tall. I would sit up at night, my hands on my knees, reading goodnight moon, staring out the window through the trees. I was always told that I should reach for the stars, but I knew it was smarter to either reach for the moon or Mars. My eyes opened wide, I knew I was special because I could fly rocket ships and little bits of anything up in the sky.
Yeah, I was all up in the corner, a strange little girl, trying hard, being so different, living in my own world. Slow reader teachers never gave me much education, but my eye was always literate for good illustrations, like tar beach, brown girl flying up in the city sky, a hungry little caterpillar turning to butterfly. And I'd always cry back when I saw the stump of the giving tree, and smile like snow angels do like Kyla and me. I ain't nothing but a lost boy. All women's college, and y'all know what that means. So this is the place Emily Dickinson roamed, with a big Irish wolfhound to make her feel at home. I stayed away from the biblical and gravitated towards the liberal ideologies and philosophies of what freedom really means. Miss Butler set the scene, brought a foundation to its knees, questioning gender roles and power goals that kept the world on lock and key.
Growing up, big books, big words, big dreams, reading up on black feminists, busting at the seams. I took Audre Lorde as my intellectual mentor, and I spoke my stories right out in the margin of center. I disidentified, I analyzed, I realized how cats like links and U's and hooks, they look into each other's eyes on Harlem Nights. My dreams glide up in the room with Giovanni, drinking beers with other queers, cause I know about when you got me right.
I ain't nothing but a lost boy.
Trying to find something that's genuine.
You have power and means that go beyond your wildest dreams. Take your time, try to find what's hidden behind the front cover of a book. Just take a second look, ready, steady, and go.
Let your imagination flow.
And don't lay low,
cause this ain't no plateau.
So keep rising and devising worlds that you know only you can.
Give every awkward girl a pen.
Let her imagination loose.
Cause you've been spitting rhymes up in her mind
since she read Dr. Seuss.
So yep, let all the fantasizers stand up tall. Cause we got so much creativity, this world's too small. Don't fall back, baby, if the first sign of trouble. Because you need your art, you need your mind to get through the struggle. I have always been a poet.
And I have always been a reader.
And as long as dreams are
should
free,
should I not always be a dreamer?
I ain't nothing but a lost boy, looking for a place to call my home.
I love new music. I love new music. New music is fun.
But that was kind of like old music and new music.
It was kind of a hybrid for our listening audience. Hey, how about welcoming a guest? Are we cool with that?
Okay. I'm kind of in my reading rainbow mode,
Nice. Guest, are you ready to be welcomed? This is a good thing. Dean Spade is an assistant professor of law at Seattle University. He previously was a Williams Institute Law Teaching Fellow at UCLA Law School and Harvard Law School, teaching classes related to sexual orientation and gender identity law and law and social movements. In 2002, Dean founded the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, a nonprofit law collective that provides free legal services to transgender, intersex, and gender nonconforming people who are low income and or people of color. The Advocate named Dean one of their 40 under 40 in May. He's won awards. He's given prestigious lectures. I'm pretty sure he passed the bar exam at some point. And in what I assume is a crowning achievement to his law career, he's calling into our show. Dean Spade, welcome to this show, Is So Gay.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, now, I think it's extremely important that we start out with you telling everyone where you are right now, because I think it's the very definition of apropos to our show.
Jeff, I've been co-organizing a day at Lake Washington here in Seattle every week, every Wednesday from 5 p.m. on. We gather queers at this particular queer beach called Jenny Blaine, and we have an event called Beachy Queen where we all swim and float around and eat snacks together. And so that's where I am. That's the beachy sound you hear behind me.
Please tell me those are waves I hear behind you.
It's true, like mini lake waves.
Wow. Oh. I want to go
there. It sounds so scenic.
That sounds awesome. It's gay and scenic.
Yes, and there's amazing queer beachwear happening everywhere.
Oh, tell us. Who would you crown as an expert in fashion? I'm just dubbing you that. Who would you crown the pinnacle of queer clothing right this second?
Oh, my God. That is such an overwhelming task.
I know, but you're up to it.
I'd have to crown Mount Rainier, which is, lording over us in the distance.
Did you just crown geography as the queer spectacle?
Yeah, I think that Mount Rainier is actually my gay boyfriend.
Nice.
Excellent.
Awesome. All right, we ready to hop in? Let's hop right into this. Let's start off pretty general. So we talk every week about all these different routes to achieve equality. As a professor of law, what role does law have in the whole landscape of achieving equality?
So I think I have a different view on this than a lot of people who've done like gay legal equality work, because I actually I have a different viewpoint, I think, in the sense that I think that people tend to overemphasize the role of law in determining the life experiences of oppressed communities. So in my experience, if you look at U.S. law, oftentimes when people raise resistance to conditions that are harming, various communities, the law will change somewhat, but the fundamental conditions facing those communities won't change, right? So, like, the legal frame will now say, oh, those people are equal, oh, you can't discriminate against those people anymore. But then in the end, and you look at the life conditions people are facing, you'll still see, extreme disparities in, income, access to housing, healthcare, all the sort of key things that people need to get by. And so one of the things that I think that frames my understanding of law is that legal change should be a tactic of movement, shouldn't be our overarching strategy. So I think that when we focus too heavily only on what some people call formal legal equality, like getting the law to say good things about us and to not say bad things about us, right?
Right.
If we only focus on that, we tend to change what the law says and then sort of legitimize the system but not actually see a lot of change in people's lives. So a good example is like anti-discrimination laws, right? Like people fight really hard for them, but a lot of communities are covered by anti-discrimination laws and it hasn't actually turned out to drastically change things that we see in the United States, like the difference between men's and women's wages or the severe racial wealth divide that we see in the U.S., the inaccessibility of employment to people with disabilities. Like, the anti-discrimination laws come in, but it takes a lot more and a lot of different stuff to change people's life chances. So a lot of the work that I've done is looking at what are the legal interventions that we need to do to help people survive and get by, things that are a lot more on the ground than big declarations by the state, like you are all equal, but instead things like what's going on in welfare policy, what's going on with Medicaid policy, what are the conditions that keep people poor and that keep other people wealthy, what's going on in prisons, what's going on with the most vulnerable queer and trans people in the United States, what are they facing, how can we start with those needs and build a movement that makes demands that are beyond what law reform can provide. Demands like prison abolition and anti-immigration enforcement, the redistribution of wealth, things that a lit law system that fundamentally supports capitalism and white supremacy probably isn't going to deliver alone. So I think it's a bit of a different framework than the kind of like, let's fight for legal equality framework that you see often framed in the LGBT media right now.
So do you have to, do you find that you have to temper, because you are in front of a classroom, in front of the future of the law, do you find you have to temper your students? Are they coming in more and more in law school thinking the law is the only route to go, the law is the only route to go?
I think that most people who come to law school, a lot of people who come to law school who want to do great stuff and really want to help change injustices they see, do tend to have an inflated idea in their mind about what role lawyers and law can have. And so I do find that we have a lot of really productive conversations looking at the history of social movements in the U.S. and saying, wow, like, did lawyers do this alone? And it turns out no. And, you know, when the law changes, it's rarely because there's, like, a really great legal argument there. It's usually because an entire community was mobilized to push for that. And then we also look at sometimes law change is actually a co-optation of those social movements. So the law suddenly says you're equal, or sort of takes words out of the social movements that the social movements were demanding, but then only to keep arrangements that are fundamentally the same or to legitimize existing arrangements. So I think a lot of my classes, especially in poverty law and law and social movements, are about helping the students both have a more critical and thoughtful view about their role as lawyers in social movements, working with lots of different kinds of strategies, not having the dominant strategy and being the one, you know, big decision maker or something,
right.
And also trying to figure out how law change often is a kind of sneaky co-optation rather than kind of like the end-all be-all, you know, we've won everything we want.
Now, we actually had, your name came up first because a law student in Brooklyn said, you must have Dean Spade on the show.
And it was worded that way.
Oh, yes.
You must.
You must. And so you are clearly inspiring law students. And one of the reasons that this student had cited having you on the show was just how inspiring it was that you started a law project at the age at which you started a law project, when most people would feel overwhelmed by such a prospect.
Or like opening a checking account.
Exactly. So what were you thinking in 2002 when we say that you were only like 16, that you were starting an entire law project?
That's really funny. I mean, I guess what I was thinking, you know, when I started SRLP, I learned a lot by working in SRLP, and I learned a lot from the people who came to SRLP for services and who were already in the existing community of activists and organizers in New York City. Like, that's really what shaped it. But when I first started, I just had this very, like, simple, straightforward idea. I applied for this kind of grant that just gives you, like, a year and a half of funding when you get out of law school to, like, try a project out. You know, it was a very narrow vision of just kind of, like, wow, I get that there's these enormous legal obstacles in front of trans people, that people are facing police brutality, facing, like, lots of discrimination in employment, facing discrimination when they're poor and unemployed and they try to get social services, like go to a homeless shelter. I see what's going on in prisons and jails for trans people. Like, something, there's a lot of need and there's not a lot of services because even lawyers are supposed to help with things like this don't get it and turn people away. And so I saw the need and I kind of, like, you know, really understood the intersection between economic injustice and poverty and exposure to certain kinds of state violence that are really, really heightened for a lot of trans people because so many systems are sex segregated that we're forced into. And I wanted to do something about that, and I wanted to, like, provide free services. But it was really when I started engaging with existing organizations in New York City, like the Audre Lorde Project and Fierce, and lots of people who had been doing homeless advocacy and organizing, where I started to understand that the project needed to be centered in racial justice, needed to become a collective that would be governed always by majority people of color and would be about more than just sort of like one lawyer doing some service help, you know, but instead about like reframing how we understand these issues and how we understand what role legal help has in raising our community's resistance. And so there was, it really was like, it became a very collaborative process really early on. These people were, you know, had a lot of vision and, you know, kind of worked collaboratively with me to make that happen and to move me out of being this sort of central figure, which is often the case with lawyers because of the way that funding works and all kinds of things, and to instead let me be just a collaborator amongst many in a really vibrant community of people who have a lot of very clear visions about what they want.
And because I'm nervous that some of our listeners might not know, hey, Dean Spade, who was Sylvia Rivera?
Oh, good question. So Sylvia Rivera was, she actually died the year that I founded the project, which is was a really, you know, obviously big inspiration for naming the project for her. But she was this person who, she was a Stonewall veteran. She was at the Stonewall Rebellion. She was somebody who, you know, a lot of people knew from that time. She was a trans woman, a woman of color, who was a leader in a group called STAR that was really an important influence in that early sort of gay liberation moment, where trans people were really a big part of it, and trans people of color and low-income trans people were a big part of it because they were on the front lines of experiencing the police brutality and abuse and violence that was so common. And as that movement that sort of we think of as having its incendiary moments be, you know, in Stonewall, as that movement shifted and changed in the 1980s, 70s and 80s, and sort of like white gay professionals came to the center, and there was kind of an idea, well, let's not deal with trans people. They're a little bit too weird. They don't make our community look assimilable enough. And there was kind of, you know, a really strong pushing out of leadership of people of color and a real centralization of white professionals. She was basically just a pain in the ass to that growing trend. She was always there saying, who are you leaving behind? I mean, at one point, she was banned from an LGBT center in New York City. I mean, she was like someone who would not let people forget who was living the front lines of violence against queer and trans people, and who always stood up for trans people and people of color and all the other people who, as she put it, kind of were put to the back of the bus of that movement or thrown under the bus. And so we really, you know, do our work in that spirit of really saying, like, this entire movement's priorities need to be turned on their head, and we need to make central those who are most vulnerable to the worst conditions of homophobia and transphobia, and we need to see these strategies from that perspective rather than sort of who has the most to gain from corporate jobs or, you know, militarism or, you know, marriage or whatever the sort of mainstream framings are that sort of tend to center white upper class perspectives.
So what I hear you saying is that there's an element of where we all have to be a little bit of a pain in the ass.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, I agree with that.
More rabble rousing. I love that we're, like, talking about the revolution on Bastille Day.
Yeah, oh,
did
is that
realize
right?
It's Bastille
Day? I didn't even know that.
Break out of our prisons.
Awesome. Well, I was reading the article that you wrote in Tikkun magazine, It's So Queer to Give Away Money. And if people have not read that article, you should go and check that out because it's a really evocative piece. I really liked it. You write about a different queer politics that is emerging. Tell us about the different queer politics that are not getting the press that they should be getting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, in the U.S., and probably many other places, but, you know, speaking from here, it's, you know, there's a very narrow media coverage of any kind of resistance, and most things are erased, and so it's really easy to not know about even, like, what our own movements look like and to only hear about the pieces that are the most available for the messages the media already wants to send, which are, you know, consumerism, white supremacy, militarism, you know, various iterations of sexism, et cetera, homophobia. So I feel like, you know, there's a really visible in the mainstream media gay politics that's, you know, focuses on marriage, that is centered in sort of the right to be an upstanding American citizen. It's, you know, it really plays to the idea that those who have immigration status and have money and have jobs that have health benefits and all those things should be able to share them with their partners. And, like, that's the story, right? And in the U.S., there's always also been a radical queer politics that I think right now is stronger than it's ever been, that has, you know, that is centered in a critique of racism, imperialism, colonialism, that is, you know, not interested in how we can become, you know, part of, you know, killing people abroad, jailing people at home, you know, maintaining wealth and poverty, and expanding, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor, but that is instead in solidarity with and centered in a politics of all the people of the world who are, you know, denied land, you know, housing, health, well-being, food, et cetera. And so that politics, I think, in the U.S. in recent years has been really visible on a few key issues. Certainly the debate around hate crimes, right? On the one hand, the sort of more well-funded gay movement. I don't use the term mainstream because I feel like that suggests that there's more people in that movement, and I think that's actually not true. I mean, I wouldn't even call it a movement. I think it's a really great media machine and has a lot of lawyers doing legal work in it, but I I'm hesitant to say that as if, you know, a bunch of people got together and had a consensus about what the best agenda would be. But anyway, it's been aside. so there's a, you know, that sort of well-funded gay message that we should have hate crimes laws that include queer people or include trans people, and there, a lot of people see it as a really big victory that the federal hate crimes law passed in 2009 that includes gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people. And then there's a sort of counter discourse that's been, I think, increasingly understood nationally, that's about why hate crimes laws are not the best way to address safety for our communities, and how what they do primarily, right, is they don't ever deter hate crimes. Nobody suggests that they, that anybody sits down and reads the laws and decides who to kill that night, and they're like, oh, I'm not going to go kill a trans person because I might get an enhanced sentence or something, right?
Right.
Like, they don't have any deterrent effects. They don't save our lives. And what they do is they increase the punishing power of the criminal punishment system, which is, you know, wildly racist, which is huge in the United States, right? We have 5% of the world population, and we have 25% of the world's prisoners here in the U.S., and it's been drastically growing for 30 or 40 years, and it will use anything to grow itself, right? So right now, it uses homophobia and transphobia, right, the call to end homophobia and transphobia as a way to further expand that system. And so there's been a real push from queer and trans communities of color, queer and trans poor communities, and other communities impacted by criminalization, saying, you know what, hate crimes laws are not the way to our safety. They have nothing to do with our safety. There are grief being used in the name of building the system further that actually is our number one predator, that, you know, the worst violence we face, the current people face, is actually at the hands of the police and in prisons and jails and in juvenile punishment systems, et cetera. And so that's been, like, I think one debate where you can see this other queer and trans politics emerging. I think you can also see it really clearly in, people who resist the idea that marriage is the way that we should address the needs of queer and trans people, and that it should be, and resist the fact that it's become such a big agenda item. And that that's sort of where the resources go when so many people, won't gain the things that are supposedly promised by the gay marriage agenda, right? Like, if you don't have any health insurance through your job and your partner doesn't, then you're not going to get health insurance because you can get married. And, you know, where is the mainstream gay movement, you know, or the well-funded gay movement on issues like Medicaid, right, which is urgently needed for, and always facing cuts for low-income queer trans people? Or it's not going to gain you immigration status if neither you nor your partner have immigration status, right? It doesn't address, because marriage as a system is a part of our system that fundamentally keeps property and well-being in the same places, right, and allows people to only redistribute them within a narrow family structure, it doesn't get at any of the structural problems that are facing queer and trans people who are the most vulnerable to poverty and homelessness, lack of health care, criminalization, et cetera. So that debate, I think, we've seen tons of writing about that. We've seen a lot of organizations put out statements. We've seen just really, increasing debate around why marriage is the place where so many of these resources are going. And I think that's been really, really useful. But I think there's a lot of examples of it, and there's a lot of examples of it in the kind of work that lots of organizations are doing around the country, small organizations, right, not the well-funded ones, are doing work specifically supporting queer and trans prisoners, or specifically trying to stop criminalization of queer and trans sex workers and other sex workers.
So I want to read, this is my favorite piece of this article. It's a little weird. It's always a little weird for me to be reading something that, you know, the guest who's on the phone wrote. But this is from Dean Spade in that article in Tikkun. Quote, "We're also talking about practice related to risk and vulnerability. In a culture with a decreasing safety net, there is enormous fear-based pressure to save for retirement, unemployment, disability, children, and other life changes. A system that individualizes risk encourages people to look out for themselves alone and steel themselves against harm, knowing that they may face vulnerability alone. What kinds of structures would our communities need to put in place together so that we could trust that we would be cared for and that hoarding does not make the world safer for us? How can our queer and trans histories with caring for loved ones with AIDS, supporting youth abandoned by their families, and supporting queer and trans elders offer models?" Dean Spade, how can we get away from that individualized to what I can only imagine is more of a community mentality that can create change?
Yeah. I mean, I think I see models of that happening all over the place. Like, the reason I included those examples in the article is because I think a lot of people can picture that, right? We know that lots and lots of people have cared for loved ones in our communities with HIV/AIDS, and that we've cared for them, you know, often because people didn't have family, traditional family bonds, blood family bonds, or because they couldn't rely on those sources in the ways that non-queer people sometimes do in health crises, right? So that's just like one example where we've seen the kind of ways that we can coordinate for each other's well-being that capitalism tells us we can't do, and that we have to all be afraid and, you know, get a private savings account and that kind of thing, or that we've seen how we find ways to take care of queer youth who don't have a place to go, not as much as we should, right, but many of us have been involved in doing that, and we've seen each other come out of the woodwork to make that happen, right?
Right.
So I guess that's what I'm interested in, is I think the best way to figure out how to have an alternative to systems that are fear-based and that encourage us to be really individualistic and hoard and not have a sense of community, is to look at examples in our own lives, right? You know, what do we already do to share with one another, to avoid bringing in the state, right? Like, I think one of the questions happening around the country right now is, if we know that the police are such an enormous source of violence in our communities and are so, so racist, what do we do when something harmful happens and we don't want to call the police because we know that they're going to make it more dangerous?
Right.
So there's all these different projects happening in cities around the country, in Seattle and in San Francisco and Oakland and New York. I mean, I keep talking to people all over who are doing projects around trying to establish other ways for people to be safe, including from homophobic and transphobic violence, without having to use the police system, which people feel is actually more scary and threatening. And so everything from trying to create safe zones, or the project in Brooklyn that the Audre Lorde Project is part of, where they're they in a particular neighborhood, they have, you know, tried to make deep contact with all these different business owners to say, is this a place where someone could run in if they were scared?
Right.
And would you be able to provide a phone? And would you, you know, like kind of really like working to say, everybody who hangs out in this neighborhood, who works here, is going to be aware of this kind of safety issues and is going to keep each other safe by being aware and by providing safety, things like that. And there's a lot of people working on sort of other methods that we can think of to ways we would deal with harm in our own lives, right, that are not about exiling people, that are not about locking people in cages, but actually, like, what do we think? Why does harm happen? Why do people do harmful things to each other? And what is at the root of it, and how can we solve it in a realistic way that recognizes that even the people who engage in harm, you know, often have a complex set of reasons that maybe we can even sometimes relate to. So just those kinds of, like, problem-solving and building alternatives is a lot of what I think is going on right now that, you know, I think is essential. We obviously need to crush the structures that exploit our fear, right? We need to, you know, end militarism and end prisons and et cetera. But we also need to build structures to replace them, right, that are structures that we can believe in and that we think actually work for our communities and do keep us safe and do keep us well.
So not just tear it down, but replace it with something, too? It's a radical concept these days in queer politics.
Yeah, well, tear it down is right.
Yeah, tear it down. We got that down pat. We just got to make sure that we're rebuilding. All right, well, we want to get you back to your beach fun, so we're going to make you do the last piece that all of our guests have to do. Dean Spade, this is the part of the interview where you need to tell our listening audience what the song selections that you have submitted for tonight say about Dean Spade.
Wow.
I know.
They were such good song selections, too.
These are good songs. All right, so we're going to start off easy, I think. What does Ladies First say about Dean Spade?
I just really love that song. It's feminist. It's exciting. I feel like people maybe don't think of Queen Latifah as a queer icon because of the way that she's been marketed in the last few years. And she has so much of her music has such a political message, and I wanted to, you know, bring that out. That song is catchy and wonderful. The video is amazing. It's on YouTube. I recommend it.
Oh, yeah. Do you believe it was 21 years ago?
And that makes me feel kind of old.
Okay, yeah, wasn't my goal. Now I feel bad. Let's do another one. Okay, what does the Reading Rainbow song that we played you in, what does that say about Dean Spade?
Oh, my God. Okay, you need to listen to every single thing the Lost Boys have done. They're such amazing young hip-hop artists. But I love that song because it's about your favorite books. You know what I mean? It's about, like, the books that politicize you. And, like, I have such a deep appreciation and enjoyment for that you know, sort of that way into ideas, and so I love a song that celebrates that.
Awesome. Yeah. All right, we're only going to make you do one more, because I think this is going to be the fun one. Dean Spade, what does the song Cheating on Your Boyfriend say about Dean Spade?
It says that it is my best friend's band.
There you go. So it says Dean Spade is supportive.
It's a very, very catchy song. All their songs are so, so catchy, and I think that one also is about summer fun. You know, there's a lot of summer lyrics in it, so I had to give it a summer.
Awesome.
Okay.
There you go. Now, where can folks go? Where can our listeners go to learn more about all the cool work that you're doing?
The Sylvia Rivera Law Project website, which is srlp.org. And also, you should know that my first book is coming out in March 2011 from South End Press.
Where can we pre-order?
Yeah, I think South End Press website, maybe even Amazon, too.
Can we have you back on the show to talk about the book?
Oh, I'd love that.
Okay. I have to tell you, there's this part of me, and let's be clear, it's not going to happen, but there's this part of me, you make a part of me want to go to law school.
Oh, God, don't do it.
Well, you know what?
Law school.
Dean, watch out. The last time he said this, he told a guest, you make me kind of want to go to Uganda. And how many weeks later did you go to Uganda?
And then I went to Uganda. This is what I'm very susceptible to the guests. But
he,
now Dean
he
Spade
booked
has said,
the flight to Uganda like the next week. It was ridiculous.
But Dean Spade has said, do not go to law school.
There's a few important times when people should go to law school, but mostly people go for the wrong reasons. So if you really have that thought process, let's talk about it in detail.
I used to really like watching Matlock. Is that enough of an impetus?
No.
Okay. Well, then I'm good. I'm good. I think we've all worked through
I'm
this.
Glad we've cleared that all up.
He nipped it in the bud.
Dean Spade, an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. You have a voice. You have a voice that we just enjoy hearing. So thank you so much for doing the work that you are doing. And keep on influencing those impressionable law students.
I'll try. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so
Absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely. Keep us updated.
Have fun on the beach.
Thanks. Bye.
All the best. That was a song called Cheating on Your Boyfriend by S. Ballot, I think is the name there of the artist. Friend of Dean Spade. There we go. Cheating on Your Boyfriend. What that song says is that Dean Spade is supportive. Yesterday, the Obama administration rolled out a new HIV and AIDS policy, and it's getting support. It's getting consternation. President Obama rolled out a new HIV and AIDS strategy to tackle the high infection rate and the stigma still associated with the disease on the home ground of the U.S. Of the 33 million people living with HIV around the world, more than 1.1 million of them are in the U.S., and every year approximately 56,000 people become infected. President Obama said, quote, "We have learned what we can do to stop the spread of the disease. We've learned what we can do to extend the lives of people living with it. The question is not whether we know what to do, but whether we will do it." And the comprehensive plan has three primary goals. Number one, to reduce the number of new HIV infections. Two, to increase access to care and optimize health outcomes for people living with the disease. And three, to reduce HIV-related health disparities, as in the stigma and the different stigmas that are associated with it.
Yeah.
Now, some are not happy about this plan. This was the Housing Works president and CEO Charles King, who interrupted President Obama, and this is what he said. Quote, "The president's plan is so flawed that it might actually represent a step backwards in combating HIV and AIDS in the United States. Since his days on the campaign trail, President Obama has repeatedly said he wants to lead the fight against AIDS. Unless he commits significant new resources intended to make major inroads against the spread of HIV, he will be regarded as a leader who did next to nothing about the most devastating epidemic of our time." Mm. So, a new HIV and AIDS rollout policy from the Obama administration. Some very happy about it, some not so much. A majority of gay and lesbian adults are regular blog readers, according to a new report released by Harris Interactive. Harris conducted online surveys to over 2,000 adults, 341 of whom identified as LGBT. The market research firm said it oversampled gay men and lesbians so it could pursue a more in-depth analysis of these groups. They concluded that 54% of gay and lesbian respondents read blogs, compared to 40% of heterosexuals. The study also found that gays and lesbians are bigger users of social networking sites, with 73% of respondents on Facebook and 29% on stupid Twitter. This compares to 65% of heterosexuals on Facebook and only 15% on Twitter. I mean, I guess we contribute to that statistic because we are on the Facebook.
We are on the Facebook.
And I did talk to my buddy Kate Pizakis this weekend,
yes.
Who sang in Notes for Life last year. She's a big Twitter proponent. Just want to put that out there. She said
really?
We should consider it. But I don't want to talk about it. I just
okay.
wanted to put that out
we'll
there.
Argue about it later.
We'll argue about it later. We have so many amazing guests coming up. If people have not subscribed to our show, you should go on over to thisshowisogay.com. And
over
you can link
iTunes.
Right up to iTunes, and you can subscribe on iTunes. It makes it a little easier. You don't have to remember to go every week. So you should go do that. But big news, big gay news. It's probably the biggest gay news. It's on the cover of The Advocate next month. There is a big switch that's happening next week in gay entertainment, in gay talk radio. This show is so gay. Moving to 8 p.m.
Oh, yes, the big news. That's true.
We are moving
it should be
to
everywhere.
8 p.m. So your podcast will remain unchanged, except that we will probably be a little bit more alert.
That's true. Maybe we'll sound all awake and
that is going to be,
organized.
That is going to be a big difference. So now, I mean, do you realize we're already like midway through July?
No, I don't realize that.
The Pride months
I'm in denial about the whole thing.
Now, what have you done for Pride this summer?
Oh, not enough.
No?
Any
parades?
No.
No parades.
No parades.
Any flag waving?
Internal flag waving, sure.
That's every day.
It's true.
I look at you right now and I'm seeing internal flag waving.
I have this radio show.
That's a good way to do
That's
it.
That's one way, right?
So guess what I did?
What?
After we talked about Uganda last week, but 2 weeks before Uganda, I did the San Francisco to LA AIDS ride, which was an absolute, absolute blast. I had such a good time. It was a totally different experience being on Gear and Tent. No disrespect to the food services people. They're very nice people. But the Gear and Tent was a much different experience.
In a positive way,
yeah,
you say.
Yeah, it was really good. It was really good. So after that, I was going to go hang out with some family. But what ended up happening was that some people from the ride said, hey, you should come with us because it ends in L.A. Mm-hmm. It ends on L.A. Pride.
Oh.
So come stay with us at this hotel and come to the parade and stuff. Now, as I have said previously, I lived in New York City for 7-8 years. I never once went to the Gay Pride Parade.
No.
I go to L.A. I went to the Gay Pride Parade. It was freaking packed. So we went out the night before, and it was just packed everywhere. And
it's
then,
always packed.
Yeah, but it was just so, there's something about just Vermont and me forgetting, oh, there's a lot of people out
there. There are a lot of people. Oh, my gosh. The last time I went through a major international airport, I was completely stunned. Just
Look
stood
at all
there.
All the people, and I don't know them. Is this the farmer's market?
I know. I went to South Station in Boston, which used to be part of my commute. And I never noticed that there were people there. But the last time I went through there, I just had to stand there for a second and get my bearings because it was like everyone I had seen in the last year in one room.
It was nutty. So I went to the parade, and the next morning I went to the parade and I watched the parade and I had a really good time watching the parade. And then from what I remember, it was a really great gay pride celebration. I danced.
You danced.
I danced in broad daylight.
Whoa.
I know. We were at a dance club and had so much fun at the dance club. And then we went to all these other places.
So you're going to start going to Pride every year?
I don't think so. I might go to LA Pride every year because there was just something about, and I do want to have someone from the AIDS Ride call into the show and just talk about, because they raised over $10 million and it was such an amazing,
amazing
event. It was amazing. And there was just something about this year. I remember last year thinking, well, I'm definitely going to do it next year. But this year, something snapped in a good way, and it just suddenly became a lifetime commitment. Hmm. Like, I just can't imagine not doing it. I wish we had something like that here. You know, I wish we had kind of this multi-day experience.
Get on it.
Oh, man.
Get working.
I don't know. It's such a huge investment. It's such a huge investment.
Well.
I don't know. But I would love to.
Or you
I
could just
to.
Fly across the country and kill all the dinosaurs in the process.
Well, Is that what killed the dinosaurs? The airplanes?
Yes.
I had no idea.
Yes, we're killing dinosaurs every time.
I had no idea. I will say that I do have some, it's certainly not guilt, but I have some ambivalence, and ambivalence isn't really the right word either, but I'm conflicted about the fact that I do fly across the country and I raise money for the LA Gay and Lesbian Center and the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. Not
when
that I don't support
have
them.
An AIDS project of Southern
right,
Vermont.
Right. Right. I mean, I'm not a resident there. I'm not someone who is going to be using their services, but I know how important those services mm-hmm. are. So again, let's reiterate before I get an angry email, I will be doing it every year. But there is this part of me that where everyone was, I think the part of me that had everyone reminding me all the time that I'm from Vermont. Oh, my gosh, you came all the way from Vermont. Because the question everyone asks you, oh, are you San Francisco or are you L.A.?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I'm Vermont. Oh, is that near San Francisco? No, it's actually a state. It is. On the other side of the country. And we have syrup and lift tickets.
And cows.
I know.
I forgot the cows.
I missed the strolling of the heifers.
You did.
Did you go?
I think I've solved your problem, though, with the airplane thing.
Hit me.
You've got to ride your bike from Vermont to California for the AIDS ride.
Yeah, that's going to happen.
Yeah, that's what you have to do.
That's going to happen. Although,
you could walk.
I've been talking it up at work. I've been talking up at work, and there might be a Marlboro contingent going to the AIDS ride next year.
I think that you should, when you're raising money, you should raise $1 for $1 for Southern Vermont.
Yes. Well, that's what I tried to do last year. It just didn't work out as well with my concert.
That's true.
And I got to decide in the next couple of days if I'm going to do the concert or not. We'll see. Anyway. All right. So you should stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com. You should subscribe to our show on iTunes. You should find our, we have a group on Facebook. We have a page on Facebook. You should join the group, like the page. You should check out upcoming guests. And as always, please send us an email at thisshowisogay@aol.com. Tell us what you're loving. Tell us what's really annoying you about me, about Becca. We love hearing that, too. After we stop crying, it's
just
really
about
constructive. Just about me. Tell me what you don't
My
like
ego
about
is
me.
Weak.
So send us an email at thisshowisogay@aol.com. In particular, if you have guest ideas, love guest ideas. There's so many people out there that we don't know about, and
we would
love to have them. And we listen. And like Dean Spade, just on the show, just a few minutes ago, that came
Good
from
job.
A listener. Yay, listeners. All right, that's it for us, folks. We're going to play one more song to get you out of here. Get out there, folks. Go do amazing things. And above all else, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay.